You're listening to All the Books, a weekly show of recommendations and enthusiasm regarding the week's new book releases. This is episode 459, and today we are talking about books being released on April 23rd, 2024, and more. I'm Liberty Hardy, here with Patricia Elsey Tuttle, and we're coming to you from bookriot.com. Patricia, hello!
Hey, Liberty!
How's it going?
You know, it's going all right. I am, you know, I've always been a very staunch rainy day, gloomy day Muppet, but I hate to admit the little bit of sun that we're finally getting is doing wonders for my mood.
It's true. But it also helps when you just get so much rain. I mean, we had no sun for like 2 weeks here. And then you're like, oh, the sun. And then you're like, ah, the sun! I'm a vampire. But like, it's still like, the sun! Yeah, it's really annoying when, you know, they, whoever they are correct about things, about like how going outside is good for you, and the sun is good for you, and drinking water is good for you, and,
you know, not kicking mental
people
health
is
blocks.
Good for you. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's like, okay, you're right. So,
yeah.
But I have also been enjoying the outside, well, looking at the outside here, because there's all kinds of little things moving around now, birds and creatures, and it's really fun. So, I did want to say, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about the mystery noise. There was like this noise that woke me up, I think I was awake, but there was this noise that frightened myself and the cats, like on our roof, and we didn't know what it was, and we tried for days to figure out what was happening. Well, the other morning, I was also awake at 5 o'clock in the morning because, you know, I just don't go to bed. Once the cats are not sick anymore, I'm sure I will sleep, but for now, I'm awake all the time. And I just happened to look out the window in time to see a raccoon shimmy up a tree by our house. And I was like, what is happening? So I think I figured out that that loud noise that we heard was the raccoon jumping off the tree onto our roof. And then the loud noise that, the loud noise that followed was the raccoon sliding down the roof. Because when I ran in the room, all the curtains were closed. So I wouldn't have seen him, like, or her drop off the roof. I think that was it. So it was very loud. But, like, we have a small house, you know, shook the house and, or, you know, but, yeah.
Yeah, but also raccoons can be really big.
Oh, yeah. No, they're huge here. And like, you know, I blame the raccoons. That's the closest I've come to, like, a reasonable explanation, because there was no earthquake. Nothing fell on the roof. Nothing fell off the roof. We couldn't find anything, so I blame raccoons. So yeah, this one though, like it climbed up a tree, it stayed up for like an hour, and then it started to climb back down. And when it got to the roof line, I was like, it's going to jump on the roof. And that's when I realized like, oh, maybe that's what it was. But this one actually just went boop down the tree. So, which is good, because I was reading online in that hour between when it went up and came down that often they get stuck. Even though they can climb trees really well, they're not so great at getting back down. And so I was like, please come down, please come down, please come down. It did. That's my exciting adventure this week, raccoons.
I don't have as exciting animal stories right now, but we set up an herb garden out on our patio in front of our house, and the lizards really like it. We have a bunch of lizards in our yard, and so they're finally, you know, peeking out because it's gotten a little bit warmer. And they are no longer scared of us. Walking by, they just kind of stare us down as we walk by them. They don't move or run away or anything like that anymore. So we're making friends.
They can't be, you know, the staring can't be very effective. I mean, they must have such tiny little eyeballs.
Yeah. And can lizards, I don't know if they could see forward or they only see out the sides. I don't know. I don't know how lizard eyes work.
I don't either. I mean, there must be like birds and squirrels and anything else that have their eyes on the side, right?
Like, I would assume so.
Do they see forward? I don't know. If we keep talking about it, I'm just going to keep sounding dumber. So instead, let's hear from a sponsor.
This episode is sponsored by Extinction by Douglas Preston. Stick around after the show to hear an excerpt from the audiobook. In Douglas Preston's Extinction, Erebus Resort offers guests the experience of viewing long extinct animals resurrected through the magic of genetic manipulation deep in the Colorado Rockies. When a billionaire's son and his wife are murdered in the Erebus backcountry by a suspected gang of eco-terrorists, Colorado Bureau of Investigation agent Francis Cash partners with County Sheriff James Colcord to track down the perpetrators. As killings mount and the valley is evacuated, Cash and Colcord must confront an ancient, intelligent, and malevolent presence at Erebus, bent not on resurrection, but extinction. Again, stick around after the show to hear an excerpt from the audiobook of Extinction by Douglas Preston.
Okay, so before I tell you about our fabulous TBR program, I want to tell you that today's corresponding area code, 459, is a general purpose area code. We are back to that. So you can use it for whatever you want. And now let me remind you that if you are looking to elevate your reading life, Tailored Book Recommendations is here to help with handpicked recommendations. You can tell the bibliologist at Tailored Book Recommendations about what you love and what you don't. You can get your recommendations via email or receive hardcovers or paperback in the mail. And with quarterly or annual plans available, TBR has something for every budget. Plans start at just $18, so visit mytbr.co to subscribe to TBR. It only takes a few minutes. That's mytbr.co. Well, all right. You ready to hear about some books?
Well, I'm ready to talk about some books.
Okay. Well, you don't have to listen to me. That's fine. You might have to stop me, though, because I could just talk about this subject for a very long time. It is The Backyard Bird Chronicles by Amy Tan. This also has an introduction by David Allen Sibley, the very famous bird expert. Amy Tan, you probably recognize her name. She's a very famous award-winning best-selling novelist and memoirist. She wrote The Joy Luck Club. She wrote The Bonesetter's Daughter. She's in the Rock Bottom Remainders band with Stephen King and Dave Barry and whoever else is in that band with the authors. This is her story about how in 2016, tired of the news and the horribleness of the world, she turned to nature. Tan lives in California, actually, San Francisco, I think. And she has actually always lived in California. She grew up there. And she has always been interested in the natural world. When she was a young girl, they lived in a home for several years that was next to a creek, and it was like the best time of her young life. She would run over to the creek and the woods nearby, and she would look at everything, you know, in the grass and under the rocks and in the water, and she would like keep track of all these little things, and she would catch snakes, and she would like poke dead things with sticks to see like, you know, what that did. And she just was curious, like, about the life cycle of nature and everything. But she realized that, you know, as an adult, she didn't pay any attention to the birds because she was so busy looking down that she never looked up. So now, as an adult, she's 72 now, but if this is 2016, she started taking these nature hikes with a renowned naturalist who writes nature guides, John Muir Laws, and they go on these walks once a month in her area and sketch what they see and talk about what they see. And he gives tips on, like, you know, how you don't just draw what you see. You know, you have to like experience the bird. You have to know about the animal that you're drawing before you can, you know, and all these like amazing tips for illustrating or drawing animals. And she becomes really invested in it. She buys a ton of art supplies, like every kind of pencil and every kind of sketch pad and watercolors, although that doesn't really work out for her, but like everything that she could possibly need and like things to hold them. And like, she explains, like she does this a lot. She becomes obsessed with something. She says she researches something that she's interested in so much. Like she needs to know everything that she can about it. She has to have the best of everything involving it. She talked about how once she had this dog, I can't remember what kind of breed it was, but she loved it so much that she bought a purebred of this dog that ended up winning the Westminster Cup because she had to have the best of everything. And she's always worried about her work. Like when she's writing a novel, she said she takes so long, or when she's writing a book, she takes so long because she needs her writing to be perfect. She needs everything to be perfect. And she wasn't sure that she would feel comfortable like drawing birds, but especially because these were being posted online, like on this website for this hike, they would share the illustrations that they had done. But she felt really free because she registered for this class under a pseudonym. You know, lots of people know who Amy Tan is, and she registered under a pseudonym. So she felt completely free to make mistakes and do terrible drawings and get the, you know, she said some of these birds could never leave the ground with the size of the feathers that I drew on them. And, you know, and this really kicked off her love of bird watching. So now she lives in a house overlooking San Francisco Bay, and she started researching everything that she needed to bring the most birds to her house and to make them the happiest so that they wanted to hang out. And I was a little jealous because we don't really get a lot of birds where I am in the winter, you know, so it must be really cool to live in a place year round where it's warm enough. You get different visitors like all year. But this book is a result of her journaling and her sketches of the birds that visit her backyard. Now, it is called the Backyard Bird Chronicles. These are only birds that visit her house. There are no NIMBYs, which I discovered stands for not in my backyard. So no NIMBYs, just only birds she saw at her house. And she makes notes about their personalities and the habits that she notices about certain birds. You know, she gives these birds personalities where, like, you know, she describes what she imagines they're thinking, anthropomorphizes them sort of. And like, this one doesn't look so well today. And this one, and she draws these beautiful colored pencil illustrations of them, but also like some of them have like little cartoon bubbles and they're saying like funny little things. She talks about her birder friends. When she first started going on these walks, she said there was this really annoying kid who came on the hikes who was like, look at this, look at that, look at this, look at that. Like she thought she was annoying. And then she realized that that kid was her when she was young. This kid is noticing everything and is interested in everything. And so she said it was kind of like cheating on an exam. She started following the kid around to see what she was seeing and learned so much more and saw so many more things than she had originally started out seeing on her hikes. And then they became good friends. And I just found this book to be so inspirational. As I've discussed in here several times, you know, I have a recent love of bird watching, which many people picked up during the pandemic. But I used to live in the woods. Not because I'm Bigfoot, but because like our house was in the woods and there were so many animals and birds, but like, I didn't really notice them because, you know, I just didn't. And now I realize like Amy Tan nailed that reason. I was always looking down at a book. Like I wasn't looking up. So I'm like, that's why I take some time and look around now and I see things. But I learned that if I look outside long enough, I always see something I wasn't expecting. Like a raccoon climbing the tree. But she just does such a great job at capturing what is so satisfying about watching birds. And the way she talks about art is also really inspiring. I actually, before I read this book, she inspired me. After I saw this in the catalog last year, I bought like 15 guides to drawing kittens and puppies and humans and birds. And I bought all these different journals and sets of colored pencils. Have I used them? No, because I'm worried, like, I'm not going to be able to do it and they're going to look bad because I'm, you know, in that camp where I'm like, I would rather not do it than fail. And it's a mindset that I'm still trying to get out of, but she has inspired me to like try again after reading this. It's so great. It's a lovely gift for birders. It's a lovely gift for people who want to read about nature or feel inspired or love Amy Tan. It is called The Backyard Bird Chronicles by Amy Tan.
Well, that's definitely on my TBR, especially given I am also in a house overlooking San Francisco Bay. We have a bird bath in front of our house and we get all kinds of birds all year. So,
see, that's another thing. Like, we need a new bird bath and we can't have one yet because it's still like that's like the easiest way to get birds to come to your house is to get a bird bath. But it's still 25, 30 degrees at night and you don't want to leave water in a ceramic bird bath because it'll freeze and crack and then you don't have a bird bath anymore. So
totally.
I'm jealous.
Yeah. We have a pair of ravens in our neighborhood.
Ooh.
That come to the bird bath. They're huge. I don't know if you've seen ravens up close.
Yes.
They're giant birds.
They are. We get them occasionally. Like mostly we get grackles, which look like little tiny ravens. And then the grackles are like bigger than a lot of the other birds that visit. And so you think like, wow, the grackles are huge. And then a raven will show up and you're like, oh no, that's huge.
For my first pick, I have Ocean's Ghidorah, a novel by Elaine Yu Cho. I enjoyed this book. When I started reading it, it felt slow, but I was absolutely misreading the slowness. It's actually incredibly calculated and deliberate in ways that I found really satisfying once I got into it. Ocean's Ghidorah is a Korean space opera about love and grief and the struggle of finding your place in the solar system. It's the 23rd century, and Korea has long since united and has cultivated the pinnacle of space exploration. Korea is the genesis of the Alliance, which is basically the space military that oversees the safety and order of the solar system, aka the solar. Ocean Yoon is a space pilot who has had a major demotion because of a past incident, and she's working on a much lower class ship than she once did. When she was 8 years old, she was sent away from the Jeju province in Korea to the diplomat school, where she was expected to train to be a diplomat until she was 18. She dropped out a year before graduation to join the Alliance. Ocean's older brother had taught her how to fly spacecraft. As a person who loves to drive and also sometimes misses the satisfaction of driving a manual, I was absolutely tickled by the care and focus that the author takes when talking about how Ocean flies the spacecraft. I had never thought I would encounter a manual spaceship, but I am absolutely delighted by it. Another character, Teo Anand, is the younger son of a hugely wealthy family, perhaps the wealthiest family in the solar. The Anand family's companies are responsible for a lot of terraforming and designing a lot of tech, especially the tech used by the Alliance. Ocean and Teo are unlikely friends. Their friendship is kept secret, and their bond is the kind that can only be formed from shared trauma. Ocean currently is part of a ragtag crew on a class 4 ship, definitely not the class ship that sees any kind of action. The captain, Day, is a bit sketchy and very money-focused. She hires on a new medic who is from a group of people that handle death and death rites. The medic's name is Haven Sasani, and his people have very strict rules around physical touch. That is, it is forbidden to touch him. His people are also looked down upon by everyone else in the solar. Day takes on what is supposed to be a fairly underwhelming mission to go to a place where there's a bunch of abandoned technology and do some diagnostic work. Everything goes horribly wrong. Meanwhile, Teo, as part of the Alliance, is part of the crew on a different ship that is escorting Seonbi, which is an elite group of scholars, to Mars. For Teo, everything goes horribly wrong. This book has a lot of moving parts and is beautifully choreographed. Content warnings for death of a family member. There is a lot of talk about grief. Actually, multiple deaths of family members, so be careful of that. I enjoyed reading it. I hope you do too. It's Ocean's Ghidorah, a novel by Elaine Yu Cho.
All right. That one is on my list. I'm very excited to read that one. My next pick is a book that I was very excited to read, but they didn't have galleys for a general review. So it actually came out last week, and I read it immediately. It's called Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder by Salman Rushdie. I 100% admit that I wanted to read this for the sensationalism. I mean, it's fascinating and horrible, and it was kind of like tabloidy to me, but I couldn't help it. I wanted to read it. Rushdie is, if you don't know, an award-winning author of more than 20 books. He wrote a novel called The Satanic Verses. I believe it was his fourth novel at the time. It was first published in September of 1988, and the book was inspired by the life of the Islamic prophet Muhammad. It has a lot of magical realism in it. It made a lot of people very unhappy. Pakistan banned it and called it blasphemous. There were protests about the novel around the world. There were book burnings. Protesters were killed. And then the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran called for his death. And some people took this very seriously. His Japanese translator was murdered. His Norwegian and Italian publishers were both attacked and nearly killed. Before I keep going, I want to mention that I'm going to be discussing, you know, violence throughout this discussion because it is about his attack. So just know that going forward before I say any more. But there were several more incidents like this. It went on for several years. He had to go into hiding. He had to get security. And slowly, over the decades, the furor died down. Eventually, he moved to the States and required less and less security, felt more and more secure. When I worked at the bookstore, we hosted him in 2012 when his memoir, Joseph Anton, came out. Joseph Anton was the pseudonym that he used to use when he traveled. And, you know, aside from like the security that the theater normally has, like he didn't have security. And it was a lovely event. But in August of 2022, while he was at a conference, which I guess this is ironic, the conference was about a program that this organization did that houses writers who are the subject of violence in their home countries. They come to the States to avoid persecution. While he was there, right as the event was starting, a 23-year-old man with a knife rushed the stage and attacked Rushdie. It was chaos. The audience didn't understand what was happening at first because, you know, time freezes for everybody. Like, who expects to see something like this happen? But several people stepped in and saved his life. Still, he lost the use of his left hand and he lost his right eye. So in this book, he talks about that incident, what he was thinking when it was happening, the last thing he remembers seeing with the eye that he lost, how he remembers what happened versus what he was told others saw or what others told him he was doing, the things that he said as they were trying to save him, you know, that seems so strange and like unnecessary, unimportant now. They had to cut his suit off him, you know, and he was upset about it. Like he was losing his suit and he was worried that the stuff would fall out of his pockets. He also said that he had a dream 2 days before this that he was a gladiator being stabbed with his sword, and he thinks it was a premonition. So Rushdie details his recovery, the various small humiliations people are subjected to when their body is healing and at the mercy of others. You know, people had to see him very vulnerable, and what it is like to be that close to death. He really was very, very lucky to have survived. And some of that was due to some quick thinking by some people who were there at the time. It's only a little over 200 pages. And this is what I wanted from this book. You know, like we look at the train wreck and hope it never happens to us, you know. And then you have someone saying like, this is what it felt like when it happened. And this is how I survived. I think it's why people are interested in true crime as well. You know, we want to know, like, if this were, like, what did you do to get through this? Or what should I avoid? Or, you know, but it is also lighthearted in places. He talks about his wife. He's been married 5 times. And his 5th wife, when he met her, the night he met her, he said he was so taken with her. It is the reason that he walked through a glass door that night. And he ended up bleeding on the floor, broke his glasses, passed out. And this was like a very happy moment for him because this is when he met his wife. And then he talks about, you know, several years later, he's in exactly the same position on the floor, you know, and it's like the most horrible moment of his life. But there is, you know, like I said, there's some levity. He quotes The Mandalorian, which I enjoyed quite a bit. I thought the book was excellent. And if you'll humor me for like 1, 2, 3 more minutes, I want to read you this quote that I thought was really interesting regarding the satanic verses, which is, you know, what started all this. He says, "I no longer feel the slightest urge to defend the novel or myself. The essay is in good faith and is nothing sacred, and the memoir of Joseph Anton contain everything I have to say on those subjects. For the rest, I am content to be judged by the books I've written and the life I've lived. Let me say this right up front. I am proud of the work I've done, and that very much includes the satanic verses. If anyone's looking for remorse, you can stop reading right here. My novels can take care of themselves. One of the benefits of the passage of time is that by now there are many younger readers who can approach the Satanic Verses as a plain old novel and not some sort of theological hot potato. Some of them love it, some don't, and that's the ordinary life of a book. Correction, that purely literary approach had become possible until that August day. One of the annoying aspects of what happened to me in Chattatawa is that for a while at least, or perhaps forever, it has dragged that novel back into the narrative of Scandal. But I have no intention of living in that narrative anymore. I thought that was a really great way to say, like, this is what I did. I'm not sorry. This is what happened. Also, something very interesting is that the trial of his attacker was delayed last year because when it was announced that Rushdie was writing this book, the defense filed for a delay because they want to read what he writes about it first. I'm assuming because they think there might be things that they can use in their defense of his attacker. Anyway, it was fascinating. It was completely fascinating. It'll take you 5 seconds to read it. Obviously, content warnings for graphic mentions of injury, violence, gore. It is Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder by Salman Rushdie.
That sounds incredibly intense.
It is very intense, but like it's actually a lot lighter, you know? But I mean, if it's not a knife attack, then sometimes we read books about people who have an illness or we read books about someone who survived, you know?
Totally.
It's like reading about that and being like, whew, it's amazing that they're alive and, you know, feeling, you know, fortunate. And it's just, you know, it's a very powerful thing to read about something like that.
Yeah, yeah, and absolutely that he has reclaimed his own story and writing it himself as would make sense for him.
Plus, you know, like, he's Salman Rushdie. He's no slouch.
Exactly.
He's pretty good at writing.
So I have something completely different for my next pick.
All right.
It is Punk Rock Karaoke by Bianca Eunice. This is a queer young adult graphic novel that I absolutely loved. Set in the south side of Chicago, school is out for the summer. Our main characters are around 19, 20-ish years old. Ariel Grace Jones is determined for their garage punk band, the Baby Hairs, to break into the music industry. They have a festival gig coming up, which they've done before, and music is life. Ariel, aka Ari, is the lead singer, and they write most of the songs for the band. As with many creatives and musicians, the reality of that in-between space between high school and whatever they're doing next is starting to hit hard. They're wondering if they should hang up their guitar and move on. Suddenly, a fellow punk musician and local celebrity starts taking interest in Ari's talent, and maybe a little more than their talent. Just in time, too, as drama amongst the Baby Hairs band members crescendos. I love everything about this book. The story is a familiar one, but it's an important one to keep telling. It's the kind of graphic novel that will definitely make some men mad, and I can just imagine the tantrums that it's going to cause, and it's delicious. This book is unapologetically punk, unapologetically black, and unapologetically queer. Personally, I found it incredibly affirming. As a black queer person who used to go to a lot of goth clubs and would notice that I'm the only black person on site at a type O negative concert, it's so rare I get to see representation like this one on the page. Speaking of goth clubs, the scenes in this book in the goth club made me laugh hysterically. The color palette of this graphic novel is perfect. It's so good. Yes, I'm biased because it's like all my favorite colors, but I just love it so, so much. Punk Rock Karaoke is simultaneously a big F you to the status quo and a love letter to the BIPOC femmes and thems of rock and the community they've built despite all the haters and thieves. This is definitely one of the best graphic novels I've read this year so far. It's Punk Rock Karaoke by Bianca Eunice.
All right. And now we're going to hear from another sponsor. Okay. So those are books that we have read and loved. And now we have some books that we're going to talk about that we haven't necessarily read, but we're excited about. I am going to kick it off Is this my third nonfiction book in a row? It is. Who am I? Maybe I swap places with the raccoon. My first pick for a book I want to read is Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent by Judi Dench and Brandon O'Hay. Judi Dench is an award-winning actor. You've seen her in a million things. She's one of the best of her generation. She has written a couple of memoirs, but this is specifically about William Shakespeare and every Shakespearean role she has played throughout her seven-decade career, on the screen, on the stage, in a park. And this is a transcription of conversations she had with the co-author. And all the triumphs and the wild tales, like on the back, there's something about being painted green and like running naked somewhere, all kinds of stories, and about how so many actors owe so much to Shakespeare. You know, he did it first. He was there first, you know, and a lot of actors have had award-winning roles playing Shakespeare characters. Many, many got their start on the stage in a Shakespeare play or were noticed in a Shakespeare adaptation or retelling. And then, of course, you just have like Shakespearean actors. I mean, there are hundreds of people on the planet who just study Shakespeare, and then thousands of people on the planet who just perform Shakespeare. They devote their whole lives to doing Shakespeare plays. Dench herself won an Oscar for her small role in Shakespeare in Love back in 1999, I think, which is one of the 10 shortest screen appearances to have won a supporting actress Oscar. She was like on screen 20 minutes total, maybe less than that. She's just so great, though. I love her. I love her roles. She's amazing. So I can't wait to read it. It's called Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent by Judi Dench and Brandon O'Hay.
I want to read that one, too.
Yeah.
I might read that one on audio.
It's also like very, very small, I believe. So.
Ah, okay. So my next pick is titled Bad Habit, a novel by Alana S. Portero, translated by Mara Faye Leatham. It is out today. No, I haven't read it yet, but from what I have read about this book, it is absolutely going to break readers' hearts. This book is set in the 1980s and 1990s in Madrid, Spain, a time during which there was a heroin epidemic alongside a vibrant party scene and wild nightlife. This coming-of-age transgender story that lays bare the hurt, terror, and violence inflicted upon our narrator. It's about the ties between gender and class, the importance of sisterhood and caring for each other, and the search for identity. Everything I've read about this book talks about how beautifully it's written, and even though it also sounds like a hard read, from my experience reading queer and trans fiction, as well as just being a queer person, there's almost always a thread of hope to latch onto. Hope is why many of us are still here. Originally written in Spanish, this English translation is out today. It's Bad Habit, a novel by Alana S. Portero, translated by Mara Faye Leatham.
All right. And my other book today that I have not read that I'm looking forward to reading is A Letter to the Luminous Deep by Sylvie Catherall. This is a futuristic epistolary fantasy romance. That's a whole lot of adjectives. It is about E, who lives in an underwater home. And she starts a correspondence with a scholar named Henry about something she sees outside her window in the water. These letters strike up a friendship and then a romance. But then at some point, her home is destroyed in a sea quake and she and Henry disappear. And a year later, her sister and Henry's brother arrive in the area to try and find out what happened to them. Whoa. I have heard wonderful things about this. I love an epistolary novel, LMNOP, you know, 88 Charing Cross Road is not a novel, it's a memoir, but still amazing. This sounds a little bit like 84 Charing, or excuse me, did I say 88? I did. This sounds a little bit like 84 Charing Cross Road, and a little bit like Remarkable Bright Creatures, and a little bit like Griffin and Sabine, which doesn't make any sense unless you've read the books, but trust me, it does. It's just, it's going to be great. I've heard great things. It's A Letter to the Luminous Deep by Sylvie Catherall.
I should read 84 Charing Cross Road again.
Oh, it's so good.
It's due for a reread.
Yeah, it's always due for a reread. It's my go-to when someone's like, I just want to read something nice. And I'm like, here you go.
There you go. Yeah. So for my last pick, I have Sweetness in the Skin by Ishi Robinson. This book is also out today, and I have not yet read it. It's another coming-of-age story focused on Pumpkin Patterson. Pumpkin is 13 years old, and she lives in a small house in Kingston, Jamaica with her grandmother. Pumpkin's mother is hardly around, and it's Pumpkin's Aunt Sophie who dreams of better things for both she and Pumpkin. Sophie gets a job in France, and she tells Pumpkin that she will send for her in a year, and Pumpkin can go live with Sophie as long as she passes her French entrance exam so that she can go to school once she gets to France. So Pumpkin's grandmother dies, and that leaves her unexpectedly with her mother, who is unreliable at best and toxic at worst. The money that her grandmother had saved up gets blown by Pumpkin's mother and newly returned estranged father. Now it's up to Pumpkin to figure out how to raise the money for her French exam and be able to go to France and get a better life for herself alongside her aunt. Like I said, I haven't read this yet, but it's definitely one I'm looking forward to. It's out today. It's Sweetness in the Skin by Ishi Robinson.
Well, okay then. So, those are books that we are excited about. And now I'm going to talk about a few paperback releases, more than a few, actually, that are coming out today, starting with a book that I read last year. I talked about it on the show. Loved it. It's called Ascension by Nicholas Binge. It's about a scientist who is asked to explore a mountain that grows out of the middle of the ocean overnight. The Weight by Jeff Boyd, a novel about a Black musician in a band in Oregon and the racism he faces in a predominantly white area, as well as the strict upbringing he's trying to get out from under. Mott Street, a Chinese-American family story of exclusion and homecoming by Ava Chin. This is a memoir about how Chin was raised by a single mother in Queens, and she goes back to examine the history of Chinese immigration in the U.S., specifically looking at the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which was the first act that was passed to forbid certain races from entering the country. Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics by Anastasia C. Curwood, a biography of Chisholm, who is an amazing, fascinating woman. She was the first African-American congresswoman and later the first Black major party presidential candidate. The Skin and Its Girl by Sarah Seifer, about a family who owns a soap factory and how one of the members has a blue baby, like literally the baby is blue, and what life is like growing up for her. Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma by Claire Dederer. This came out last year. It's nonfiction that talks about what it's like loving art that we discover is created by problematic people, or when the art that we love, like the people who created it, are later found to be problematic. Juno Loves Legs by Carl Geary. I can't remember if I talked about this on the show, but oh my goodness, this is one of my favorite novels from last year. It will destroy you. It's so devastating, but so good. It's about two teens growing up in Ireland in the 1980s. The Making of Another Major Motion Picture Masterpiece by Tom Hanks. Yes, that Tom Hanks. About the making of a superhero movie and the comics that inspired it and the actor who is starring in it. The Ugly History of Beautiful Things, Essays on Desire and Consumption by Katie Kelleher. I have not read this, so I'm just going to read this little thing here from the publisher that it is about the fraught histories of makeup, flowers, perfume, silk, and other beautiful objects. Fieldwork, A Forager's Memoir by Ileana Reagan. This is Reagan's memoir of her life as a chef and a forager. She's an award-winning chef who forages for much of the food that she serves. The Late Americans by Brandon Taylor, about a group of close friends in college who are getting ready to leave school and what the future means for them and their friendship. And bringing it back to Willie, Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies, How Doubting the Bard Became the Biggest Taboo in Literature by Elizabeth Winkler. There's always been speculation that Shakespeare did not write his plays or all of his plays, and this is an examination of that, some of the people that it was thought to be, and how doubting that Shakespeare wrote his plays could get you a lot of hate. So, there we have it. Patricia, what are you going to read next?
I am currently in the middle of a book I talked about last time I was co-hosting this show with you, which is There's Always This Year on Basketball and Ascension by Hanif Abdurraqib. And then next, I'm also going to read Disability Intimacy, Essays on Love, Care, and Desire, edited by Alice Wong, and that is out next week. What are you reading next, Liberty?
So I, because I only ever want to read the book that I don't have the most, like, you know, so the other day I watched a conversation with Grace Curtis, who wrote The Floating Hotel, which came out a couple of weeks ago. And Grace mentioned that The Bridge by Ian Banks is so amazing, totally sold me on it. So I got a copy of The Bridge by Ian Banks, which is like an older novel. Ian Banks has been gone for several years now. But that sounds great. And also, there's this book, I think it's a TikTok thing, I don't know, but it's called Voyage of the Damned by Francis White that like everyone is talking about, but it hasn't been out in the US. It's only available in the UK. So it's coming out here in August. So I'm going to read that and see what all the fuss is about. Then yeah, that's it. And I'll probably change my mind in like 5 minutes because that's what happens. I'm tired and cranky.
Until a shinier book pops up.
Yeah. Or, you know, this like lack of sleep I realize is like affecting my reading, and sometimes I'm like, is it me or is it the book? I can't tell. I read a book the other day, I started it, I quit after 10 pages because in the prologue they mentioned the character being one age, but then a couple pages later they mentioned her being another age in a different year, and it didn't match up. Like, she should have been like 5 years older than they said she was in the first chapter. And I was like, well, if you can't do the math, I can't be bothered to read this. And like, you know, which is so unfair, but I'll probably pick it up
again. I love that's where you draw the line. That's where you draw the line.
You know, it's like, it's a finished book, you know, and
that's fair.
I feel bad for the author that this was missed. And also like, it's totally unfair of me, and I'm sure I'll still read it, but I'm just so cranky lately.
We all have our own boundaries, and sometimes they shift depending
on
our
mood.
That's
where I draw the line. Yeah. So that's what I got. So that is it for us today. You can visit mytbr.co to subscribe to TBR. It only takes a few minutes. That's mytbr.co. Thank you to our sponsors. Thank you to our awesome audio editor, Caitlin Brame. You can drop us a line at allthebooks@bookriot.com. Patricia, where can people find you online?
Mostly Instagram at TheInfophile.
Okay, and I mostly hang out on Instagram at FranzenComesAlive. And if you want to give us a treat, you can go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever it is you get your podcasts and leave a rating or review. We would love it if you would do that. It helps other book lovers to find us. And as much as we would love to tell you about more books today, we just don't have the time, but you can read about more titles out now in the show notes at bookriot.com/allthebooks, as well as find a link to our weekly new books newsletter. And for more recs or general bookishness, check out bookriot.com. And don't forget to check out our full stable of podcasts at bookriot.com/listen, or just search Book Riot on your podcast player of choice. And in the meantime, happy reading.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's show. Now here is the audiobook excerpt from Extinction by Douglas Preston.
"Look over there," said the guide in a hushed voice, handing Olivia the binoculars, "on the far side of the lake. Olivia Gunnarsson took the binoculars and directed them toward the turquoise pond, which lay a mile away at the bottom of the cirque, below their vantage point. It took her a moment to locate the woolly mammoths, four big ones and two smaller ones on the opposite shore. She touched up the focus, and the animals sprang into sharp relief. It took her breath away. They were so gigantic they looked almost fake, much bigger than the elephants she'd seen on a safari in Africa. The bull was drinking deeply. He was 15 feet at the shoulder, his tusks, great scimitars of ivory as long again as his body, sweeping outward from a shaggy domed head. The matriarch of the family was standing guard, her trunk elevated and moving back and forth, warily testing the air as her calf huddled under her protective bulk, pushing his head upward to suckle. An older calf splashed in the shallows, dipping his trunk and playfully squirting water from it. It was early fall, but here in the mountains, the mammoths were already growing out winter coats, the long brown hair hanging down several feet. Olivia was thrilled. It was a scene straight out of the Ice Age, the family of mammoths lingering in a lush meadow bordering the pond, with the glittering snow-capped peaks of the Erebus Mountains of Colorado forming a majestic backdrop. To one side of the group stood a grove of fall aspen trees, their leaves a cloud of shimmering gold, rustling with every swell of the breeze. "Mammothus columbi," whispered the guide, "the largest of all the mammoths, the northern subspecies with fur. That bull weighs at least 10 tons. Olivia continued staring through the glasses. The bull finished drinking and playfully sprayed water from his trunk at the young one, who squealed in delight, the faint sound drifting across the valley. "Incredible," she breathed. As a girl growing up in Salt Lake City, Olivia had been crazy about dinosaurs and wanted to be a paleontologist, until skiing had taken over her life. "Don't bogart those binocs," said Mark, Olivia's husband. "Sorry," she said with a laugh, handing them over and giving his shoulder an affectionate squeeze. She was so mesmerized, she'd almost forgotten the rest of the world existed. She turned to their guide, Stefan. "What will they do when the snow comes?"
"They'll move lower down in the valley and take shelter in the forests," he said.
Their guide, Olivia observed, was one of those super fit, older men who seemed to be made of cords and cables, with a grizzled beard and leathery skin, exuding a sense of vigor. She wondered if Mark would be like that in his 50s. Probably. He would never let his fitness regimen slide, and neither would she. "In winter, what do they eat?" Mark asked.
"They'll tear down the aspens and cottonwoods and eat the twigs and buds, and they'll paw up the snow to get the mosses and bushes along the creeks and bogs. They wreak havoc, but it's an environmentally good kind of havoc. Since being rewilded, they've changed the ecology of the valley, opening up meadows and churning up the ground, which increase the landscape's carbon absorption by 50%.
"Looks like they're coming around the lake," said Olivia. Even without the glasses, she could see them on the move, the matriarch leading the way, moseying along the shore. "They're coming our way."
"Nothing to worry about," said the guide. "They're as peaceful as puppy dogs."
Thank you for listening to this clip provided to you by Macmillan Audio. To hear more, look for this title wherever audiobooks are sold.